experience with the Dead Sea Scrolls is just about everybody has heard of them, but very few people seem to know what they actually are or what significance they have, although most people know they're important, don't know why. There's also, we may talk about in a moment, a reference to Dan Brown, but I also find the Dead Sea Scrolls tend to come up in like spooky places where people are like, there's secret things in the Dead Sea Scrolls, or they have hidden secrets about Christianity. And so hopefully what we will do tonight, if nothing else, is you'll leave knowing what the Dead Sea Scrolls are. You may not know everything in them, as we'll talk about, but understand how they impact Christianity, understand how they impact our understanding of the world of the Bible, understand how we got our Bibles, and you'll find there's nothing all that shocking or strange or peculiar about them, but a really fascinating and a really important discovery, which we'll talk about for several reasons. Before we can really talk, though, about the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think what we have to do is talk a little bit about biblical studies, our understanding of the scriptures prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We'll get into the story a little bit, but the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, 1948. And so what I want to do is talk about prior to that date, our understanding of the Bible, the biblical text, and that'll become more relevant as we talk about how the Dead Sea Scrolls came to light and what we learned from them. So prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, these were the three oldest manuscripts of the Old Testament that had been discovered. The oldest is what is known as the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo Codex, it's actually a really interesting story. It was within a synagogue in Aleppo, Syria. And during the 1940s, same time, 1947 or so, when there was a lot of sort of persecution against Jews throughout the Middle East, particularly because of the immigration into Israel, the synagogue where the Aleppo Codex was being attacked, and in order to preserve it, it was smuggled out of the country. It did not resurface until much later into the 50s, and part of it was missing. It was missing most of the Pentateuch as well as some other sections. The story at the time was that it was damaged in the fire at the synagogue. More than likely, it was probably sold off into private collections, portions of it. So the current version of the Aleppo Codex is in Israel at the Israel Museum, but it, at the time, was the oldest one. And you'll notice the date. These dates are going to be important. So the Aleppo Codex, it actually has a date on it when it was written. So these older manuscripts would often have an end plate that would have details about who the scribes were, what scribal system they participated in, the dates in which they had done the work. And so the Aleppo Codex is dated to 920 Common Era or AD, so 920. So you're talking kind of the early Middle Ages. The next oldest one is the Leningrad Codex, which it is a complete version of the Old Testament, but it's from around the year 1000, according to 1008. The Cairo Codex is questionable because they don't believe the date that's on it. They believe it's actually newer than the date that's on it. It's not as old as it claims to be for a whole lot of reasons that probably aren't worth us going into. But it's probably from somewhere around the mid-1000s. So what I want you to get from this slide is this. Up until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest manuscripts of the Bible, the Old Testament that existed, the oldest one was from 920. And most of the others were from around the year 1000. Up until that time of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, these were the oldest texts we had for tracking the Bible that we have, the Hebrew Bibles that we have, for understanding how those scribes had kept track of those. And so I brought my copy. I have some show and tell tonight. I brought my copy of the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia. I'm sure, Josh, you have a copy of this probably somewhere too. It's my Hebrew Bible. So if you want to look through it, the kids will like it because it reads backwards. So Genesis is at the end because they read the opposite direction. But these Hebrew Bibles, like this, were primarily based on these manuscripts from the 900s and 1000s. And most of our modern English translations, they're working their way back to these versions of the Old Testament that we had. So to give you a little bit of a look at that as well, too, you'll hear these described as the Masoretic texts. If you've ever heard, the Masoretes were a particular group of scribes in the year 1000. And one of the things they were doing is, this is modern Hebrew. One of the things you'll notice here in comparison to this is there's all of these dots and dashes that don't exist. This looks a lot cleaner. Hebrew is a language of only written consonants. There are no vowels in the written Hebrew language. So I'm jumping a little, but this is going to be the Dead Sea Scrolls. You'll notice it has none of the dots or dashes. Those dots or dashes are the vowels. The way that you understood how to read this was having listened to it read and understanding the tradition of its reading. So you could have a Hebrew word that had the same three consonants, but would have different vowels that weren't actually written, but you would memorize having heard them or from the context, and those vowels could change the meaning of the word. So the ancient manuscripts they had, you primarily learned to read them by having heard them read or the context of them. And what the Masoretes did around the year 1900 to 1000 is they were worried that that tradition was dying out, that people wouldn't be able to read them for themselves. So they developed this way of what are called vowel pointings or markings, the system of marking vowels, of marking accents. And so you start getting texts that have all of these dots and lines. Modern Hebrew, interestingly enough, most modern Hebrew doesn't use vowel markings either. They just only use the consonants, and you learn to read it through context. You'd be surprised if you've ever seen some of these where they take an English sentence and like only show you the top of the line, and yet you can still read it, or you could remove the vowels from words, and you'd be surprised how often you can still read it in English. That's how the Hebrew is working. But the important point is, most of what we know about the scriptures, most of our modern translations were coming from the work the Masoretic scribes had done and the way that they were preserving this tradition. That brings us to a few questions, which we're going to talk about in a moment, because many times in the past, people wondered if this was accurate. Had the Masoretic scribes been faithful and consistent? Because remember, we only have these texts going back to about the year 900 AD, 1000 AD. Second thing we should talk about prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls was the sources we have on understanding the first century. And so there's really three primary sources prior to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some of these will sound familiar. We've talked often about Josephus. So Josephus was a Jew in the first century who ended up in Rome and wrote several long histories of Jewish wars, of Jewish history, his own personal biography. There are questions about Josephus. He's clearly from the first century. That's true. He is a defector to Rome. And so most of his writing and telling of history has a particular slant to try to help Romans or the state of Rome understand the Jewish faith. But he clearly is a massive source for understanding the world of the first century. The other source that existed was Philo, who is a Hellenized or a Greek Jew living in Alexandria, Egypt. If you read Philo, he's very philosophical. He's interested in integrating classical Greek philosophy and Judaism and trying to prove Judaism as a significant contributor to those Hellenistic philosophical conversations. And then this one's important to talk about because most of what was known of Judaism from the first century is known through the rabbinic tradition. If you've been to these lectures before, sometimes even on Sundays, I've talked about some of those early rabbinic writings, the Mishnah. The Mishnah was written around 200 AD, and it was a compilation of the oral tradition, the verbal teaching that the rabbis had been teaching. After the Mishnah, you have what's called the Tosefta, which is the addition to that. And then ultimately, you get to the Talmud, which is a collection. There's two Talmuds, a Babylonian and a Jerusalem Talmud, that are really collections of the discussions of the rabbis around scripture. And most of what scholars understood about Judaism from the first century came from these sources, Josephus, Philo, and this rabbinic tradition. Now, the problem with the rabbinic tradition is none of it is actually written in the first century. Much of it seems to be oral tradition that may go back to the first century, but it's written much later. And the other problem was, which we're going to talk about with the Dead Sea Scrolls, the rabbinic tradition probably preserves the Pharisaic tradition. Now, go back to our very first lecture when we talked about all the various Jewish sects. Do you remember? There's rabbis, there's Essenes, there's the Sadducees, there's all these groups of zealots. Probably what you're getting in the rabbinic tradition is just the rabbis and the Pharisees after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. It's preserving this oral tradition and written much later. All that to say, it's not written in the first century, and we're not sure how comprehensive the view of the rabbinic tradition was. So we have the sources from 900 to 1000. We have these historical images of the first century. And then the other thing I think is worth pointing out is some of the common objections you get before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So a couple of things you would often hear, probably these are still lurking around. It's surprising to me how often you hear these, considering how important the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls are in relation to them. But number one, you often will hear, We can't have confidence that our biblical texts represent the original documents because the work of generations of scribes have introduced errors and changes and inserted texts. This was one of the big challenges. Look, we only have Old Testament books that go back to the year 1000. There's another 1,000 years, 2,000 years of scribes. Who knows what those originals look like? They've clearly been changed. This is one of the big criticisms or critiques. The other one is, when you read the New Testament, what you're really reading is later church traditions or church theology that is being written back into the first century. And what critics would say is, look at all this stuff Jesus is saying and teaching. This doesn't sound like anything we hear being discussed by the rabbis. Therefore, this can't be from the first century. This must be later on in church history. They're writing these things back, their own conversation questions, into Jesus' mouth, into the Gospels. And so you still hear these ideas around. You can't trust the Bible. All of this is later church theology that's being written back in. This is where the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think, as we'll see at the end too, have its biggest impact. But to really understand how significant the find was, you need to sort of understand this is where criticism is prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay, a little bit of the history of their discoveries. And this is the part I really geek out on. So I tried to be very focused. You don't need to know all the details. We'll take questions, but the highlights of the history, because it's really a pretty fascinating story. So the story starts, and we're going to come back to this map in a little bit. But this is the Dead Sea. If you saw a larger one, you can visualize. You have the Sea of Galilee above that runs down the Jordan River. Jerusalem is just up here. Jericho is just to the north. This is the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. So you have Jordan, modern Jordan over here. And the first cave you'll notice is marked Cave 1. And then there is this community or settlement that's called Qumran. The story goes that there were a group of Bedouin shepherds, probably three of them, probably two of them teenagers and one older. The story they often told was that they had lost a goat and they were looking for this lost goat that had wandered off. And they had thought this goat went into a cave. And so they had followed the goat into the cave. And lo and behold, they found inside the cave these jars and scrolls. We'll look at in a moment. Probably what happened was these Bedouin knew that there were often stuff in caves from ancient times. And anytime they had a free moment or a spare moment, they were climbing in caves they could find, treasure hunting, hoping to find something that they could sell of value. So the story is probably somewhere between those two things. But this is actually a photo of Cave 1. So what you're looking at here is from the Dead Sea, you get a kind of a broad platform, and then you get it going up into these cliffs. And all throughout these cliffs, there's caves. There's probably a lot more caves than we know, but they've been caved in or the entrances are blocked. And so Cave 1 is actually up in these hills. It's very hard to get to. You can hike to it today, but it's not. You're in the desert. You're in the wilderness. This is not a place. You're off the Dead Sea. It's not a place that people lived or were frequently going to. These were shepherds. And this photo is actually Cave 1. But when they would have seen it, this entrance and this entrance wouldn't have existed. Those were opened up to be able to have access to Cave 1. The only thing that existed was this hole up here, which is higher. They had to actually lift one of them up to drop inside. And the story goes that they threw a rock in and heard the rock break pottery inside. And that was the incentive for them to climb up and try to lower themselves down into this cave. When they got into the cave, what they found was a collection of jars. So this is actually from the Qumran Museum. They're showing you perhaps what it would have looked like. And as they broke into these jars, what they found were, at the time they didn't know, but they were covered in like a pitch or a tar and wrapped in a fabric. But they could tell that they seemed to be some kind of leather. They didn't know they were scrolls. They were even on the external a little too deteriorated to read. And so they were highly disappointed that this was not gold or treasure or Roman swords. And they actually didn't know what to do with these. So they carried them out, put them in a bag. And according to the story, for several months, these scrolls were in a bag hanging inside of their tents. And a couple times they actually unrolled them and realized they had writing on them, but had no idea what they were. So they brought the scrolls to a gentleman in Bethlehem who was a cobbler. He made shoes, and he also dealt antiquities on the side, so ancient things. They assumed because they were leather and he worked in leather as a shoemaker, he might be interested in the leather itself. And he knew enough to know that they were some sort of writing, although he couldn't read or recognize the ancient Hebrew script. In Bethlehem, Bethlehem was primarily Christian or Arabic at the time, so Muslim. And so he did not recognize it, but had connections. So these scrolls passed hands. There were originally seven scrolls that came out of Cave 1. and they passed hands around until finally a couple of them were in Jerusalem in an antiquity dealer's hand who showed them to a Jewish archaeologist named Eliezer Sukanik. So this is a picture of him. The first time Eliezer Sukanik saw the scrolls, because he was Jewish and the antiquity dealer was Arab, he actually viewed them through a barbed wire fence because Jerusalem had been partitioned by the British in their preparation to pull out. Remember, if you were here for our Modern State of Israel lecture, we talked a lot about 1947. Britain was pulling out. So he recognized, he had done a lot of his archaeological work on ossuaries or bone boxes in tombs, tombs that they knew were from the first century based on pottery. And he recognized that some of the writing on these scrolls, because remember, the oldest Hebrew we really have in written form is from 900. This Hebrew looks different in the same way that a 1,000-year-old English would look different on a page than modern English. But he recognized enough of it to think that it looked like the Hebrew that had been scratched onto the ossuaries that he had seen in first century tombs. And he's looking at these literally through a barbed wire fence, but is convinced that these are ancient and authentic Jewish scrolls. The problem is the scrolls go back to Bethlehem, the antiquity dealer who has them. That is over into Arab territory, and he is Jewish. He can't easily cross over. And the day that he decides he's going to risk the trip to Bethlehem to try to purchase these scrolls on behalf of Jerusalem, he runs up against the fact that the United Nations has scheduled its vote to declare Israel a nation the very day that he's trying to go to Bethlehem, which is Arab, which his family knows, as soon as this vote goes through, there is a large likelihood that the region will turn to immediate violence and chaos, and you're crossing into Arab territory. Turns out the UN decided to delay the vote by 2 days because they were filibustering and needed more votes. He decided, without telling his wife, that he was going to risk it, dressed in an Arab outfit with one of his Arab friends, and snuck into Bethlehem, purchased the scrolls, and brought them back. And he writes in his diaries that he had the great Isaiah scroll we'll talk about in a moment open on his desk, and he's translating the scroll and realizing what it is as he's listening in the background to the radio of them declaring the state of Israel emerging after 2,000 years. I think it's particularly interesting because we'll talk about this in a moment, but the scrolls most likely end up in the caves seen by people for the last time in 70 AD when Israel is destroyed by the Romans, putting down their revolt, which means this scroll pretty much got hidden on the day that Israel no longer had independence and literally to the day emerges again in the hands of this Jewish archaeologist on the day that it becomes a state. It's a pretty remarkable story, isn't it? So Eliezer Sukanik was able to purchase three of the original seven scrolls. The other four got purchased by a man named Athanasius Yoshea Samuel, and he is the bishop, they called him, it was the metropolitan, of the Syrian Christian church in Jerusalem. So he liked old documents, old church documents, and he purchased the other four of these scrolls, not knowing exactly what they were, but eventually was able to determine that these were ancient Jewish scrolls. When war broke out in Jerusalem, the War of Independence, 1947, he ended up taking the scrolls with him first to Syria and eventually to the United States. So by 1948, he had taken these four scrolls, these ancient Jewish scrolls, out of Israel. Sukanik knew about them and was trying to purchase them, but he smuggled them out. Sukanik wasn't able to get them. Sukanik died a couple of years after the discovery from a stroke. And so his son, a famous general in the Haganah, the Israeli Defense Force, named Yigael Yadin, had been studying to be an archaeologist, but when war broke out, went into the military service. When he got out, he took over his father's work, translating these scrolls, the three that he originally had. And it just so happened that he was in New York City doing lecturing on the scrolls when Athanasius Samuel decided to list his scrolls for sale in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. He literally took out an ad saying, the four Dead Sea Scrolls. The problem was, they knew that Samuel, who had been driven out and was really pretty hostile to the idea of a Jewish state, wouldn't be interested in selling them to Israel as a nation. So they actually sent an undercover individual to purchase these as an American, even though they were using Israeli government money to purchase them for a museum. And Yigael Yadin was actually, and this is the son, his father had discovered the first three. His son actually acquires them in New York City and brings them back into Israel and they found the, they take all seven of these Cave 1 scrolls that are now in the possession of Israel and build a museum around them that we'll look at in a minute. So a pretty dramatic story how these scrolls end up back in Israeli hands. It is hard because after the War of Independence, you'll remember if you looked at those maps when we talked about the modern state of Israel, that portion of the Dead Sea, that portion of the Judean wilderness right there actually is in Jordanian hands. So Israel does not own where the Qumran community and the Dead Sea Scrolls are. They actually become the property of Jordan. And so after the war, our scholars rush in, they learn about the story of this cave, and they start searching other caves to find more scrolls, and they do. But because those are under Jordanian territory, the scrolls are actually taken, many of them, into East Jerusalem, which is not a part of Israel, it's a part of Jordan. And it's pretty shocking. They actually would only allow Jordanians and Christians to work on the committee translating and organizing the scrolls. The Jews were cut out of the entire process, even though they're ancient Jewish documents in Hebrew. And the Jewish scholars wouldn't actually get their hands on the Dead Sea Scrolls until the war, the Six-Day War in 1967, when they took the rest of Jerusalem. They actually captured the museum that had all of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and most of them then became the possession of Israel. As they began to explore more of the caves, there were 11 caves altogether where they found scrolls. There's actually been another one that's from the Bar Kokhba revolt later, but technically 12 scrolls that they'll refer to, or 12 caves they'll refer to as the caves of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Most of the scrolls from Cave 1 were complete full scrolls. We'll look at some pictures in a moment. But many of the other caves only had fragments. Some caves, literally all there were tiny pieces. I love this picture because these are tables full of tiny little scraps of scrolls where researchers are trying to decipher sometimes a single word of Hebrew or a phrase from Hebrew. But from that, they could figure out what book that might have been from as they would piece together what manuscripts, what scrolls existed. All of these scrolls ended up being put into a museum you can go to. I've been there in Israel. They call it the Shrine of the Book. So from the outside, it's a strange-looking building. The museum's actually underground to protect it, they say, from even bombings. But if you look at the top of this, it looks like a fountain, but it's designed to look like the lid of one of those jars that the scrolls were found in. And when you go inside, this is actually the top of the museum. And inside, underground, all of the walls are covered, and there's what looks like the wooden spool of a scroll. And the Isaiah scroll from Cave 1 actually wraps the entire length around. So this is the picture of the Isaiah scroll at the center of that museum room. So if you go today, you can see many of the Dead Sea Scrolls on display, as well as the Aleppo Codex that's all there. I told you I'd keep the history focused. We could do a lot more with the history, but I think that gives you a sense of a pretty remarkable story. A word about naming, because I'm going to use some of this, but if you ever leave here and decide to dig more into the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's helpful to understand a little bit about how the scrolls are named. So here's a picture of all 11 caves. Whenever you're looking, this is what you'll see when you see Dead Sea Scrolls reference. You'll see things like 4Q14 or 11Q Melek. This is the naming convention. The number at the beginning refers to which cave that scroll or fragment was found in. The Q stands for Qumran, which we'll talk about. And then after that, you'll get, if it's a prominent book of the Bible or a significant portion of a book that exists, you'll get the name. So for instance here, 1Q Isaiah or 11Q Melek. And then you'll get sometimes just a fragment number. So 4Q14 means this is K4 at Qumran, the 14th fragment that they found. And so for scholars, they're able to find these and look them up. Sometimes you'll get superscript A, B, C. This refers to multiple versions of Isaiah. They found two Isaiah scrolls in Cave 1. So there's technically a 1Q Isaiah A and a 1Q Isaiah B. So let's talk a little bit about what they actually found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So first of all, Cave 1. So I said Cave 1 had seven scrolls, and most of these were completely intact. The first was a complete scroll of Isaiah known as the Great Isaiah Scroll. The second was a variation of the Isaiah Scroll that seems to be in a slightly different translation of Hebrew. It might be something like ESV and NIV, something like that. They also found what's called 1QS, the community rule. We're going to talk about some of the different genres of literature within the Dead Sea Scrolls, but this is specifically a document about life or initiation into the Qumran sect. You have 1Q, this is basically the Pesher. I think it auto-corrected to Peter for some reason. That should be Pesher. It doesn't know the Hebrew word Pesher. Pesher on Habakkuk. Pesher is like a commentary. So this specific scroll is a running commentary or thoughts or writings on the book of Habakkuk. Then you have the war scroll. This is a sectarian book specifically about a coming apocalyptic battle. You have the Thanksgiving hymns, which read very much like the Psalms, but they're not the Psalms that we know in the Old Testament. They seem to be in the first century or slightly before, more modern Psalms associated specifically with the Essenes. And then you get the Genesis Apocryphon, which is actually a retelling of the Genesis story. So it's the beginning of Genesis and part of Exodus. The next question to talk about is the dating of these scrolls. So as scholars are looking at these first seven scrolls, recognizing this is ancient Hebrew, these documents don't say this is the year I was written and by who. So a lot of what they're using initially was the actual script or the handwriting, and then the ability to carbon date some of the material. These are parchment or leather. And so they believe that most of the scrolls in the Dead Sea collection are from the 3rd century BC to the 1st century CE. So this is 200 BC through 100 AD. So now put that in perspective. You have the entire Isaiah scroll, possibly as old as 200 BC. The oldest version of Isaiah that existed in that Aleppo Codex was from the 900s AD. So you're talking about scrolls were found that are now 1,000 years older than the oldest documents that we had in our Bibles. It's pretty, we had scrolls that were 1,000 years old, and we found scrolls that were over 2,000 years old. It's a huge jump for them to find documents that old. This is the great Isaiah scroll. I think it stands out and is worth mentioning. It includes the entire book of Isaiah. The scroll itself is 24 feet long with 17 stitched together sheets of leather, and they believe it to be dated to 125 BC. So pretty remarkable. And if you see photos of it, what's also remarkable is how readable it is. I mean, you can tell even from this. You may not know Hebrew. I can't read it very well because my Hebrew is not good enough to read the Dead Sea Scroll Hebrew. But you can see the letters very clearly. It's incredible that this is over 2,000 years old and it was so well preserved. Probably the reason these exist is because of their location at the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is the lowest point on Earth. It's really, really dry. They may get only one or two rains a year. The way that they were preserved in the jars in this arid place is probably the only reason they lasted as long as they did. But yeah, pretty remarkable. Probably the best way to think of the Dead Sea Scrolls is not to think of them as scrolls, but as a library of scrolls. Altogether, as they excavated the 11, now 12 caves, they found 15,000 fragments that they believe represent 950 to 1,000 unique scrolls. So think of a library, 900 book or 1,000 books on a shelf. That's the kind of thing we're talking about with the Dead Sea Scrolls across multiple caves. This isn't just some scrolls somebody put somewhere and forgot about and we found them later. This represents a massive library. And also consider the fact that scrolls were very expensive to produce. The leather itself was expensive and time-consuming. A scribe who was trained and disciplined enough to write 24 feet of Isaiah and make sure it's accurate and correct, these were expensive to produce. So you have a community here that has a massive library. And the scrolls break down into three different genres or categories. So the first, about 40% of the scrolls are considered biblical scrolls. They found evidence of every single book except for Esther. Esther is not in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And depending on how you count Ezra and Nehemiah were probably originally one book. They have portions of Ezra from the caves, but not Nehemiah. That may just mean that the Nehemiah portion deteriorated and they just have Ezra, or it may mean that they have Ezra without Nehemiah. But for sure, Esther is not included. The second genre, about 30%, are Jewish literature books. So books that scholars knew about, some that they didn't have in Hebrew. So some of the books like Enoch, Jubilees, they knew and had in other languages, but not Hebrew. But you have Jewish literature, things people would have been reading in the first century, perhaps books that Jewish sects like even Qumran might have considered a part of their canon of scripture. But these are non-biblical books, but books that are common to Judaism of the time. The third genre of books, about another 30%, are what are called sectarian scrolls. These are books specifically or writings specifically related to the community at Qumran. So the community rule, which talks about initiation or life, the Thanksgiving Psalms, the temple scroll, which talks about an imagined future temple that they would construct, the war scrolls that talks about a future apocalyptic battle. These are documents that don't seem to exist elsewhere in Judaism, but were specifically related to the Qumran community. So 1,000 scrolls, a whole library of scrolls, 11 caves. The next question to probably ask is, who put all of these scrolls in these caves? That's initially what scholars were asking. Who do these scrolls belong to? Why are they in caves in the middle of the wilderness? The idea that they're from Qumran is obvious now, but at the time, they weren't sure. They knew of an ancient site at Qumran, but it had never been excavated until the discovery of the scrolls. So as they began to excavate, they found an interesting, you can visit this today and walk through it. They have a visitor center, but an interesting community. It has buildings, it has structures, it has a lot of ritual baths. It's clearly a Jewish settlement of some sort. It does not seem to have homes. So there's speculation about if the people in the community lived in tents or perhaps lived in the caves around it. It's also interesting because there's a cemetery, and with the exception of a couple of female bodies that they think are actually from later times, all of the skeletal remains are male, which is also peculiar. So what is this? How does it relate to the scrolls in the caves? Well, they have a couple pieces of ancient evidence. So a little broader map. You have Qumran, which is here, Jerusalem up here, Jericho. If you keep coming down, you have Engedi, we're going to talk about in a moment, and then Masada. Many of you know the story about the Jews who committed suicide at the end of the Jewish revolt, 73, at Masada. Masada is down on the southern end of the Dead Sea. So Pliny the Elder is a Roman historian from the first century who was trying to travel the world and write a complete natural history, describe all of the lands and people of the entire known world. And he actually specifically writes about the Essenes and the Dead Sea. And so he writes, on its west side, the Dead Sea, just far enough from the shore to avoid its baneful influences, live the Essenes. They form a solitary community, and they inspire our admiration more than any other community in the whole world. That's quite a statement. They live, he's talking about their religious devotion. They live without women, for they have recounted all sexual life. They live without money and without any company, save that of the palm trees. Below their headquarters was the town of Engedi, whose fertility and palm groves formerly made it second only to Jerusalem. Okay, so what do we have here? A description of it being male only, a description of it being some sort of a religious site, the fact that it existed north of Engedi on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. Well, Josephus also gives references, a couple other in the ancient world, but scholars pretty quickly decided that Qumran must be this settlement that Josephus and Pliny are describing as belonging to the Essenes. We talked quite a bit about the Essenes in that lecture we did on the different various sects, Sadducees, Pharisees, and Essenes. So I'm not going to do a ton on the Essenes. But pretty quickly, scholars said, okay, if Qumran fits these descriptions as being the community of the Essenes, then these caves that surround Qumran, these scrolls like the community scroll that specifically talk about life of the Essenes, this must be an Essene community and these scrolls must belong to the Essenes. A couple other things about the Essenes. Josephus says that the Essenes lived in a community in the wilderness, fits Qumran, but he also says that the Essenes lived throughout all of the major cities. So according to Josephus, the Essenes had settled not in one city, but in large numbers in every town. They actually found evidence of an Essene community within Jerusalem from the first century as well, in that Herod the Great had built an Essene gate. So on the south side of the city, you get the gate of the Essenes. This is a little side thing because I think it's interesting here. Why would they have their own gate in the city? Well, part of it because the Essenes seem to have practiced a certain kind of purity or living completely pure lives. They wanted their own baths, their own separation. But they also had interesting rules that made their life unique. So hopefully you find this entertaining. One of their rules said that you were not allowed to use the restroom inside of the city, and certainly you couldn't on the Sabbath. Josephus actually writes about this, that the Essenes would not use the restroom on the Sabbath at all. They felt it was a violation of the Sabbath. And the reason for this was, they said, in order to use the restroom, you had to be 3,000 cubits outside of the holy city. So you had to walk 3,000 cubits. The problem is, on Sabbath, you're only legally allowed to walk 2,000 cubits. So Josephus specifically says because of this, they would not use the restroom on the Sabbath. And probably they have their own gate so that they could easily leave Jerusalem. They found latrines, believe it or not, along with ritual baths outside of the walls of Jerusalem that they believe were specifically for the use of the Essenes. So I have to give it to you. This is a description of the bathroom practices of the Essenes from Josephus, who were very interested in this, given the ancient context where people pretty much did what they wanted, where they wanted, when they wanted. On the other days, they dig, so this is non-Sabbath days when they're not holding it. On the other days, they dig a small pit a foot deep with the paddle of the sort given to them when they are first admitted among them. When you became an Essene, apparently you were given a trenching tool that you carried with you for this purpose. And covering themselves around with their garments that they may not affront the rays of God, they ease themselves into a pit. This is so strange in the ancient world that Josephus feels the need to document it in his histories, his history of wars, that the Essenes practiced this kind of not only celibacy and ritual purity, but they were so particular in their kind of purity that they had regulations and laws and rules about how they would cover themselves in purity even when they were relieving themselves. And so this is what you get. The Essenes, they're probably the ones that have put these Dead Sea Scrolls in the caves. The last time that they were probably used by the Essenes was the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. There's two theories. So what we know happens is when Vespasian and his son Titus come in to put down the great Jewish revolt, they run three campaigns, the 3 years building up to 70 AD. So the first campaign is in red. They're basically trying each, you think about wars, this happens even today, you hear the conflict in Ukraine, there are certain seasons when the weather isn't conducive to conflict, so the lines sort of stop progressing. That's happening in the ancient world, there are certain seasons that they're campaigning. And so in the first campaign, they conquer the coast, they try to capture all of Galilee, which they do. In the second campaign, they try to take all of the strongholds throughout the region. And then in their third campaign, they basically lay siege to Jerusalem and sack Jerusalem. There's two theories. Qumran was either captured during this second campaign or when they came down and took Jericho. There's a great story that Vespasian, when he conquered Jericho, had heard about the Dead Sea and that you couldn't sink in the Dead Sea. And so Josephus says that he took Roman soldiers who couldn't swim and had their hands and legs bound and threw them in to see if it was true and they would float. And they did. So lucky for them. So because apparently, according to Josephus, you had Vespasian coming to the Dead Sea on the second campaign, then perhaps Qumran, which lays about here, was captured by the Romans in 68. I think it's more likely that after the fall of Jerusalem, Vespasian is gone and Titus sends an operation to come around and take Machaerus. Machaerus is where John the Baptist was beheaded, so interesting side note. But they take it, and then they march around the sea and end up taking the last of the zealots at Masada. I think it's most likely after 70 AD that in this cleanup around the Dead Sea, they take Qumran. There's evidence parts of Qumran were burnt. They found Roman arrowheads around the towers. So it does seem like there was destruction from the Romans. And interesting, cave 4 of the 11 caves is the most fragmentary. All of the documents in cave 4 are in really small pieces. And scholars think some of them show signs of piercing and cutting. And so some scholars theorize that the Romans actually found the scrolls in cave 4 and destroyed the scrolls, cut the scrolls up and destroyed them, but apparently did not find all of the other caves. And so those documents, there's two groups of caves, lower caves that were probably working caves. The scrolls were kept there for use. And the higher up caves like cave 1 were probably those scrolls were put either for long-term storage or specifically to hide from the Romans, knowing that the Romans were coming and going to lay siege to Qumran. So the last time those documents seem to be in use is prior to the destruction of the Roman during their siege, their campaign to put down Israel. It's a lot of history, a lot of the scrolls themselves. I did bring you a couple other books you can look at. So I brought my copy of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I thought what's helpful, because remember, most of it's fragmentary, but you can see how big the Dead Sea Scrolls are. We're talking, and this is just representing in many cases, you know, small fragments. You can see here there's just a few words, dot, 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 a few words. So you can see how much writing and how much material. We're not just talking about a few scrolls in jars. We're talking about a massive library. So you're welcome to look at that. And then I also brought, this is actually from Sukanik, the first Jewish scholar. It's the first publication of the scrolls from Cave 1. And so feel free to look at it and be careful. There's a book that has it. And then in addition to the book, there's actually photos of all of the fragments and scrolls from Cave 1. It's pretty interesting. So if you want to see what those look like, you're welcome to come up. eBay. It's amazing what you can find on eBay. So.
Just like the newspaper.
Just lots of searching. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so what I really want to get to is a couple things. Why are the scrolls important? So this is really what you should take away. It's great to understand what they are. I think that's helpful. They're not you know, secret other gospels that have the truth of Jesus. There's nothing like that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. All of the scrolls have now been published. So there's no like hidden things the church is repressing from getting out because of what it says. You know what they are, but what do the scrolls mean? Why are they important? A couple things. Number one, they're an opportunity to compare the manuscripts we have, our versions of the Old Testament, now with versions of the Old Testament 1,000 years earlier than before. And what you find is there are differences. Most of those differences are things like the spelling of certain words. Sometimes you'll have place names change. They'll be updated to a more modern reference of where the place is. Occasionally, you'll find variations that seem to be related to translations. So sometimes you'll find the Hebrew that more matches the Greek versions of books of the Bible we have than the Hebrew versions. But overall, what was so surprising to scholars was how consistent the writings of these Old Testament books were to the books that we had from 1000. And what that means is this idea that the scribes are changing and inserting and adding and erasing, and these are a combination of later scribes piecing things together. Well, 1,000 years before the documents we have, they basically have been preserved without any significant change, which means for 1,000 years, those scribes had been faithfully and consistently copying with careful attention. Here's how one scholar put it. There are relatively few examples of passages that are totally different in the Dead Sea Scrolls than they appear in the medieval Hebrew manuscripts. We looked at those, the Masoretic texts. And the majority of the passages that are different match some other known version of the Old Testament. This means that the Old Testament has been copied and transmitted with remarkable accuracy. It is not a stretch to say the Hebrew Bible known to Jesus is essentially the same as the one known to us. All of this leads to the conclusion that the Dead Sea Scrolls sometimes complicate, but generally confirm our knowledge of the Old Testament text. What was so surprising to everyone is the Biblia Hebraica Tenzia that I have, that printed, you know, a few years ago, basically looks almost identical to what they found in the Dead Sea Scrolls from 2,000 years ago. This faithful transmission by scribes, keeping and preserving these traditions. Second thing. We're given a fascinating glimpse into the complexity of the Jewish faith in the first century. There was no one uniform Judaism, and this is one of the real mistakes. I said one of those critiques you'll often hear is that the theology of the New Testament has been written back in. And a lot of that comes from this idea that if we read the rabbis have preserved what Judaism looks like. But the Dead Sea Scrolls gave us this whole community, documents we had never even seen before from the first century, that preserved an entirely different take on Judaism in the time of Jesus, the Essenes and how they were practicing it, completely different than those in Jerusalem, than the Pharisees around. And so you get a sense that the first century world is far more complicated than this idea of it being one simple Judaism. And the reason that matters is this. The Dead Sea Scrolls help better understand Jesus and the first Christians. We don't discover new things about Jesus. Jesus isn't written about in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Christians aren't written about in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But what we do begin to understand is many of the things Jesus and the first Christians are doing and saying that seemed strange and led some scholars to say, well, perhaps these are from church history and written back into the time. The Dead Sea Scrolls actually make a lot of those things make sense in the broader conversations that were apparently happening in the first century. And so I want to give you three of those as our way of sort of wrapping up. The first one is John the Baptist. A few things we know about John the Baptist. He was preaching in the Judean wilderness. His emphasis was on water baptism as a kind of repentance or as a preparation for something new God was doing. And he certainly has this messianic expectation that he was preparing the way for the Messiah. Many recognize that John is quoting, Gospel John specifically references that John the Baptist is like this wilderness voice preparing the way for the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. It's interesting you find this verse referenced several times in the Dead Sea Scroll text, that they saw themselves fulfilling this same idea, that the Qumran community thought they were a voice in the wilderness. John is doing most of his ministry and work in the same region of Qumran, down by the Dead Sea and the Jordan. And then you also, this is interesting, listen to this description and think about what we know of John the Baptist. So this is from 1QS, the community rule. This is the document about initiation into the Qumran Essene community. This is not in the Bible. Nobody knew about this existing until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Essenes write about their own practice. By the Holy Spirit of the community, in his truth, shall he be cleansed of all his sin. This is a new initiate into the community. And by the spirit of uprightness and humility shall his iniquity be atoned. By his soul's humility towards all the precepts of God shall his flesh be made cleansed with the sprinkling with lustral waters and sacrificed in flowing water. And he shall establish in his steps to walk perfectly in all the ways of God according to his command concerning his regular feasts. And he shall step aside neither to the right nor to the left and shall make no single step from all his word. Then will he please God with the agreeable expiation, and it will obtain for him the covenant of the eternal community. That's a really interesting thing to read because you've got a couple things going on. You have water baptism as an initiation into this community of the Essenes. You have them saying that after this baptism, he will concern himself with walking properly in all of the ways of God. Do you remember even in Luke when John was baptizing them for the repentance of sin, they say, how now shall we live? And he says to the tax collectors, don't take more than you're supposed to. And to the Roman officers, don't use your power wrongly. It's interesting. You have this same idea that this water baptism as initiation is actually going to change the way I'm going to live. This language of the work of the Holy Spirit and this baptism as an initiation into a community. The point here is not to say that Jesus or John the Baptist were practicing Essene baptism. I don't think that's what is happening. There's plenty of differences with John from the Essenes. But a lot of this idea of baptism as a rite into the community, scholars looked at the rabbinic teachings and said, well, there was a baptism that they would practice, a ritual cleansing for worship, but there's no initiation of baptism. This must be a later church tradition that they've written back into John the Baptist and the teaching of Jesus. But with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you find, well, turns out there's groups of people in the Judean wilderness baptizing for the forgiveness of sins as an initiation into a community. Well, Jesus, this isn't a church tradition later written back in. Jesus actually fits with this broader understanding of what's happening, the conversations in Judaism. Let me give you another one. I think this one's particularly interesting. The rejection of the temple. When you read in the Gospels that Jesus says, tear down this temple and I'll raise it back up in 3 days again. And by it, he was talking about his own body as the temple. Or when Jesus is rejecting the temple and turning over tables, many scholars would say, well, this must be Christianity's take on the rejection of 70 AD, the destruction of the temple, that clearly the church is looking back and recognizing Jesus saw this coming because no Jew in the time of Jesus would have spoken against the temple. Well, you find something really interesting. In Qumran, you find them describing their own community as an embodiment of the temple, a kind of spiritual temple. The Essene community actually no longer practiced worship in the temple in Jerusalem because they thought it was corrupt. And some scholars think even the layout of the Qumran settlement is meant to be a kind of mini temple, and they were practicing their own kind of temple worship. But they talk about themselves in relationship with one another as the new temple. So this is from a Midrash from Cave 4. He has commanded that a Mikdash Adam, so this is Hebrew for a temple of men or a temple of humanity. You see the word Adam, right? So this can mean Adam in Genesis. It can also mean humanity. A temple of humanity be built for himself, that there they might send up like the smoke of incense, the works of the law. So this is fascinating to read from the first century, that there were Jews in the time of Jesus who had rejected the temple and had started to spiritualize the temple and its worship by saying that we are becoming a community, a temple of believers together to make sacrifices not of animals, but sacrifices of righteousness or good acts. So when Jesus begins to talk about him being the temple, or in the New Testament we read about the body of believers being the temple, again, another area where this isn't later post-destruction of Jerusalem, Christian doctrine being written back, but very much a broader idea that seemed to be throughout Judaism at the time. Let me give you another one. Sacred meals. So this is from the community rule. One of the things that the Qumran community seems to have really practiced was every day they ate together, and they had very particular instructions on how they came together for this meal. It was considered a religious meal daily for those participating in Qumran. And so you get this description. I'll just let you pay attention to some of the details that stand out. When they gather for the common table, interesting language, or to drink the new wine, and the common table is prepared, and the new wine mixed for drinking, let no man stretch out his hand over the first fruits of the bread and the new wine before the priest. For it is he who shall bless the first fruits of the bread and the new wine, and shall first stretch out his hand over the bread. And afterwards the Messiah of Israel shall stretch out his hand over the bread. And afterwards the whole congregation of the community shall bless each other in order appropriate to his honor. It is in accordance with this statute that they shall proceed at every meal at which at least 10 men are gathered. Okay, so instructions for a meal, a few things to point out. This is not in this passage, but there's a ceremonial washing that takes place before they're allowed to eat this meal together. They come in from the fields, wash, then they go in to eat. You notice that there is bread and wine at this meal. You notice that it concludes with worship, a prayer, a blessing before and after. And also it has this expectation that they're practicing something that one day the Messiah himself will preside over. So there is a remembering and anticipation of it. And then really interesting, do you remember in Luke chapter 22 when Jesus is at the Last Supper with his disciples, which big surprise, that's what I'm comparing it to if you haven't caught that yet. It says immediately after Jesus had done this, passed out the bread and the wine, that the disciples began to grumble with one another over who was the greatest. A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Well, at Qumran, we're told that they would enter this meal and they would sit in order of their seniority, that the place you sit in this meal together was marked by your place within that community. And so it's interesting, you think, well, why are the disciples arguing about who's the greatest when they're sitting at this meal? Well, perhaps there is this kind of communal meal taking place in broader Judaism that's taking place in what Jesus is doing, where I sit is important as a part of this celebration. Again, were the Essenes practicing the Last Supper before Jesus? No, there are significant differences in what Jesus is doing. But the point is, this idea of bread and wine is not some sort of later Eucharist tradition that the church writes back into Jesus. We actually find in the first century, this gospel witness is consistent to this broader context or world of Judaism. So what we could do a lot more than those. I gave you three of them. And I think the bigger point I want you to see from the Dead Sea Scrolls, I doubt you're going to go home and pore through all 1,000 fragments and become a scholar. I certainly have not. But a few things to sum up. The Dead Sea Scrolls are a powerful tool in confirming the confidence we have in the accuracy of the Bible. If somebody tells you, oh, good grief, this has just been all sorts of scribes adding stuff and taking stuff and editing stuff, it's a really ignorant thing to say, because over and over and over, with more and more discoveries, people are shocked by how faithful these scribes have been to preserving the accuracy of the text. Second, the New Testament stories that we have, the gospel witness, fits into this world of the first century in ways that we didn't even realize until suddenly these Dead Sea Scrolls and this new witness from the first century emerged. And what you find is that these gospel writers, often when we thought what they were saying was strange or peculiar or didn't fit in our image of the first century, well, suddenly with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it fits remarkably well into this broader understanding of Judaism in the first century. Okay, I managed to squeak that in an hour. So I'm happy to take some questions. I'm happy books are making it around. You're happy to look at those. I can go back. But that is a really basic overview. There are whole courses on the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a great, if some of you listen to the great courses on Audible, there's a really excellent, I'm happy to recommend, course on the Dead Sea Scrolls you can take on there that's like 20 hours. So we could do a lot more. But as far as an introduction, I think that's a good one for tonight. Any questions I can answer about the Dead Sea Scrolls?